UBB. We won, right? Well, now I'm not so sure. I pretty much said that we won when the decision came from the CRTC, the rethink of the usage-based billing decision. The Harper government, with their foot on the neck of the CRTC, you better overturn this pro-UBB ruling or else. Well, last Tuesday the ruling came. As expected, it was a complete rejection of what Bell wanted. A press release came out of the Save Our Net folks, the folks who collected 500,000 signatures in support of their campaign against UBB. And Save Our Net, the open media guys, they declared victory. Bell lost, the people won, big win for the internet. That's what it sounded like to me. That's pretty much what I said. Give me some commentary on the decision about a half hour after it was handed down on CBC Radio. That's the feeling that I expressed on Twitter. I was just so happy that a popular movement could work like that. I mean, this clearly was something that would never have been rethought had it not been for the hundreds of thousands of Canadians who cared so deeply about it. It seemed like this was an instance where people actually made a difference. And that's what made it such a bitter pill to swallow when other information started to come forth. The first mitigating factor was a press release from TechSavvy, the independent internet provider here in Ontario, basically saying that this decision did not go the right way at all. The next day, as the dust settled even more, and analysts had a chance to really contend with the full repercussions of this very complicated and long CRTC decision. And the picture that started to emerge was one that was not so definitively pro-consumer and not so definitively anti-cartel. I've been reading all of that analysis. I still don't have my head completely around what the implications of this decision fully are. So today, let's try to get to the bottom of this. And just in no uncertain terms, you know, I left a little bit of wiggle room when I was on the CBC. I said that, you know, this decision, certainly we needed some time to parse it and there was room for criticism, but it was basically a pro-consumer decision. I think I may have been wrong. You know what they say about breaking news? It's often broken. And what I try to do here on Search Engine is, after a little bit of time has gone by, dig a little bit deeper. So if you got the wrong idea from my earlier comments, I do apologize. Let's fix it now. To take a close look at the CRTC's decision, I'm joined by George Berger. Now, George Berger is an advisor and a spokesman for TechSavvy. He's also a lawyer and an executive with decades of experience in entertainment and telecom in Canada. I can think of nobody better to take us through this and tell us what it's really going to mean for those of us who care about the future of an open and unmetered internet in Canada. George Berger, welcome to Search Engine.
Hi, Jesse. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Correct me if I'm wrong here. The UBB ruling came. UBB is dead. Bell's proposal is rejected. This is a win, right? This is a victory for the people, no?
Actually, the short answer is no, not in any respect is it a victory for the people. I think that the impressions that were given early on were largely a result of the complexity of the decision. And the fact that there were two distinct parts to it. One part to it was the conceptual part in terms of how the actual billing system would take place. But the second part was the rates that were going to be applicable to it. In terms of the conceptual part, they got it right. They were essentially introducing a system where the billing is done on the basis of capacity as opposed to usage. But unfortunately, when the pricing gets applied to it, it becomes prohibitively expensive to engage in heavy bandwidth activities.
So the big print of the decision that we were no longer going to be metered, that's the right approach. And then sort of at the back of this decision, there's all this small print with the rates of what indie ISPs like TechSavvy and Akanak and the rest are going to have to pay to Bell and Rogers. And that's where you feel like this was not a win.
That's exactly right. And I think that what makes it all the more curious in terms of how it was arrived at, how the decision was arrived at, is the disparity in the tariffs that are essentially put forward by the various incumbents. So going a little bit by memory, because I don't have it in front of me, I know that Bell claimed to ask for a 22 or some odd dollar fee per meg in terms of speed, and MTS Allstream asked for $2.80, just about a discount of a factor of almost 90%. Rogers was in the range of about $12, and I think that Cogeco came in actually higher at about $27. So they were really all over the map, and typically when these tariffs are submitted, they're submitted essentially in sealed envelopes because they're confidential, which results in two things. First of all, of course, none of the incumbents share that information with each other as they submit it, which could result in this kind of disparity in terms. If you would think about it as a bid process, you're inevitably going to come up with disparities because they use different parameters on how they choose to couch their bids. But more importantly, it also means that it becomes very, very difficult, actually impossible, for any third parties or anybody who's, I guess, contrary in interest to them, to be able to analyze the numbers and to be able to critique them. Any analysis that takes place with respect to the numbers is done strictly internally at the CRTC. And so there's no transparency whatsoever in that element of the process.
All right. That's a lot of information. I want to try to make sure I understand it. Let's unpack this. These numbers are what the ISPs are telling the CRTC. They're saying, okay, if we're being forced to sell capacity to these independent companies, then we've got to figure out how much we're going to charge them for the whole wholesale access. And are we talking about like what they charge for a set amount of bandwidth? Like this is what, you know, you guys, we're going to give you 1,000 gigabytes to sell to consumers, or is this about capacity, like just access to the network itself?
Well, it is in terms of bandwidth, because they're selling bandwidth in packs of 100 meg packs.
Uh-huh.
And so essentially you've got to predict if you're a retailer that wants to access the system on a wholesale basis, you've got to predict what your needs are for the upcoming month, and you've really got to get it right. Because if it turns out that you buy too much capacity, then clearly you're going to be overpaying and it's going to cost you there. And if you buy too little capacity, then the problem is going to be that you're going to be unable to serve your customers properly. So leaving aside the financial complexities and the financial hit that the entire market is going to take on this, there's also the internal complexity that the retailers are going to have to take on, and they're going to have to manage themselves.
I mean, this is something that has been a mystery for a very long time. Just what does this stuff cost? And, you know, the incumbents, they'll charge you one price if you're on a certain plan. So people were doing calculations that you'd be better off just couriering data, like actually buying a hard drive and sending it through a courier than paying these over fees. I mean, it's just been a completely arbitrary price tag associated with this, and it seems like this is a continuation of that confusion. There's just no consistency or consensus on what bandwidth actually costs. Is that what these closed envelope figures are about?
I think that that's certainly what they reflect. I think that the confusion in terms of what's a fair price for wholesale access continues to remain in the equation. I think it becomes even more confusing when you consider that there's really two sets of pricing applicable on the one hand to residential and on the other hand to business. One would think that bandwidth is bandwidth is bandwidth, but the CRTC seems to think otherwise, and they've really constructed two different methodologies for that as well. So that adds another layer of, I guess, uncertainty as to how these numbers are arrived at. In principle, let's step back for a second, if you don't mind. But typically, when there is a regulated introduction of competition or a regulated encouragement of competition in a business where competition has not previously existed, the typical route that's taken virtually around the world is to arrive at a fair return for the suppliers of the infrastructure. So, for example, when gas service was deregulated, there was obviously a tremendous amount of capital cost sunk literally into the ground in providing pipes and so on. And in order to achieve the policy objective of deregulating the gas business, they applied a cost to that infrastructure, a fair rate of return as a markup to the people who sunk that capital, and then anybody could access that infrastructure if they paid that price. But there was clarity, there was transparency, there was a definitely consistency in terms of how those prices were arrived at. And that model is typically followed in virtually every single industry and every single jurisdiction in the world. So the idea of using somebody's sunken capital in order to encourage competition is neither unfair, nor is it foreign, nor is it unusual. What is unusual is the complexity that seems to dog this process continuously when it comes to the telecommunications field.
So unlike gasoline, where you might say, like, okay, we're going to all get together and put our heads together, have a negotiation and come out, like, this is what a gallon of gasoline costs, and then everybody goes from there. It doesn't matter if you're using it for a business purpose or a residential purpose, or, you know, you can't have a 1,000% disparity between what one company is going to charge for that unit of gasoline and another. You know, you would set an industry standard. You put a price on that commodity. Here we have this other commodity, which actually is, unlike gasoline, is not a scarcity economy. It exists in ubiquity. And yet there's none of that standardization.
Not at all. And in fact, it's the exact reverse, because intuitively you would assume that the greater efficiency is achieved by the person that invests in capital with greater density. So theoretically you would expect that the cost of that infrastructure would be less for Bell than it is for MTS. But MTS, of course, is in a very sparsely populated market. And yet, despite that, even though they've got to reach all those people in at very large distances, which, by the way, is the typical reason that Bell gives for the hardships and burdens that they have to face, the reality is that MTS's hardships and burdens are far greater than Bell's are, given the capital
sorry,
cost.
Sorry, just slow you down. The hardships and burdens of that last mile of internet, delivering it to a dispersed rural population that supposedly is much more difficult and expensive than doing it in an urban population, and yet MTS in Manitoba, they have that problem in spades, and yet they're offering a price that is wildly more competitive than what Bell is offering.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Okay. We're in the fine grain details here. Let's step back and let's just talk about, like, the consumer end of this. Tech Savvy has residential customers. They can get high-speed internet, 300 gigabytes a month right now for $31.95 plus some taxes and such. Or they could get unlimited at that same speed for $39.95 plus a little of this and that. How is that going to change? Are we getting any clarity from your end and the indie ISP's end? What would 300 gigabytes a month cost under this new regime?
Actually, I can't help you with that because I'm not close enough to that process right now. And in any event, that process is just underway. So that I don't think that there's any clarity on the part of anybody who's as central to the process as possible. So it's a little early to figure that out. You have to understand that because of the complexity of the decision, that initial very dark black headline response that we had to the UBB decision back in February or January actually is a little bit missing. It's taking a little bit longer for this to sink in. But in many respects, the impact of this is far greater in terms of its adversity to the interests of consumers than that UBB decision was. Because what they're really saying is, well, that's fine. You can we're not going to cap your usage. But for the usage that you're going to use, you're going to pay through the nose.
Yeah, the negative repercussions might be much greater because at least with the UBB decision, there was clarity to the public as to this is something, oh, we understand what that means and we don't like it. And then you had this amazing popular response that I think is the only reason that the decision went back to the CRTC. Now it seems like the waters are very muddy. And I'm wondering if you're going to be able to, I mean, the only thing that people are going to understand, I guess, is their bill. You guys only have combined 5% of the market. I just wonder what the future of the public resistance to this kind of pricing is going to be.
I think it's going to be a question of how well the public is going to be informed. And again, going back to your very first comment, I think that you'll probably be finding that some of the commentary from the consumer advocacy groups is definitely being scaled back considerably from the initial comments on day one.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of second thoughts going on, and more than second thoughts. And now that actually people are actually understanding the ramifications of this, I think that there's certainly the part of the headline is, yes, they got the concept right. But unfortunately, the pricing is so bad as to really make this not a step forward, but rather a step back. And
okay. Let me try to find a silver lining here. You know, so the part they got right is the way that they are going to be charging. The part they got wrong is how much they're going to be charging. So, is there not an opportunity for you to fight on that front and say, look, you guys got this, the structure right, you know, to be paying for capacity is the way to go. Now let's take another look at these numbers and let's renegotiate those. I mean, isn't that what the associations of independent ISPs are going to be fighting for at this point? Can you go back to the CRTC and try to get better numbers?
There has not been any strategy formed yet. Simply because it's early days, there's been no strategy formed yet on how to respond or what the ask should be. So I really can't purport to speak for anybody's thinking except my own. And as far as that's concerned, for what it's worth, I think that one very, very strong push has to certainly be for a review of the pricing, but I think that also there's got to be a complete review on how that pricing process takes place. Because the idea of continuing to maintain it as a confidential process when the stakes are so substantial to virtually every single Canadian citizen, when you have such a dramatic disparity between essentially the bids from the various incumbents, you have to question whether the process is appropriate. And I think that in the, given the stakes that are involved, I think it's not inappropriate to be asking for a much more transparent process. And however that's achieved, I think it should be pushed for. But right now, leaving the review of these bids to the staff of the CRTC to determine their legitimacy or not, I think, especially given the outcome, probably is not sufficient to ensure a fair outcome.
Well, that cuts to the quick, and this really is something that affects every one of these issues. I mean, talk about throttling of peer-to-peer traffic, and you know, there's just so many issues where the response from the incumbents is, we have to do this because of congestion, we have to do this because of bandwidth hogs, and when you say to them, okay, can you show me that congestion? Can you document that your network is getting strained? Can you show me what it costs you, you know, so that when you charge me $3 for a gigabyte of overage or 30, that has some reflection in reality. They do not share those numbers. And when they share them with the CRTC, they're not sharing them with the public. So is that where the fight moves? Is the fight now for transparency in the network itself?
The fight, actually, it's a bit of a leading question, Jesse, because from my point of view, the fight is really about a complete overhaul of the regulatory framework from top to bottom.
Uh-huh.
Because it has failed the consumer over and over and over again in the last several years. I want to emphasize that there is really no finger pointing here at the incumbents. This is their business. They have a responsibility to their shareholders, and they're entitled to engage in as forceful and a robust advocacy as they can in order to protect their interests. I find that completely legitimate. By the same token, I think that it's also important to understand where they're coming from and make sure that it's put to the closest examination possible to make sure that all of that advocacy is legitimate and fair from the consumer point of view in the context of a regulated industry.
Well, it's not, right? I mean, you know, part of this decision was the CRTC found that Rogers was fluffing their numbers, and they found there was no legitimacy there. We know that the CRTC, when they get complaints about throttling, legitimate complaints, they don't do anything about it. Your finger might not be pointed at the incumbents. I agree. If I had an oligopoly to protect, I would probably do it exactly the way that they are. Your finger seems to be pointing right at the CRTC.
That's not entirely fair, Jesse. And I'm not trying to sound like, you know, a really non-combative Canadian or something like that. I think the fact of the matter is that the overall structure really needs a rethink. In terms of the mandate that's given to the CRTC, the objectives as established by legislation, and it has to be a coordinated push. Right now, I think that the Canadian public is really facing like a very important tipping point in terms of their relationship to the internet going forward. And there's right now a patchwork of elements, all of which are related, which have to do with how that experience is going to unfold over the years. I think you must have seen the article with the head of Wind, and you know, he was very, very forceful and very specific about his problems with investing in Canada because of the difficult regulatory environment in which he operates. And you know the history of that. I mean, I think probably most of your listeners know the history of that as well. But his language is exceedingly forceful, and the internal to-ing and fro-ing on these issues is unfortunately going to have international, or is already having international repercussions.
What sort of international repercussions?
For the word to get out that in this area, Canada is not a friendly place to invest, the only people who are going to suffer from this are going to be consumers. I think that where there was an opening found for the ability of Wind to set up business, with the whole foreign ownership issue between industry's point of view versus the CRTC's point of view and the final resolution in the Federal Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, I think at the end of the day, people really have to acknowledge that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and it puts a damper on people coming in here to invest. And yet it's exactly that foreign investment that has led to a significant reduction in wireless costs in Canada. So the example and the benefit is right in front of your face. So we're dealing with that issue right now with the foreign ownership considerations at the Ministry of Industry. I think that's an ongoing process that's going to have to be determined before the spectrum process gets announced, or concurrently with that, and the sooner the better. And then we have the vertical integration problem that the market continues to face. We have the over-the-top issues that the market has to deal with, and now, of course, this wholesale pricing matter. So these four elements are essentially the foundation of how Canadians are going to be dealing with wireless and directly and indirectly internet access. And it's done as a patchwork as opposed to a coordinated strategy to address these issues.
Would allowing foreign capital in on all fronts, you know, anybody who wants to bring money in here to offer zeros and ones, be it through the internet or wireless, would that solve all four of those problems?
It would definitely change the landscape because, and by the way, just to be clear, there's two routes to relaxing foreign ownership restrictions. One of them is to do it across the board, in which case foreign ownership would be accessible to everybody in Canada, from the incumbents down to the smallest players. And then there's the other one, which is a phased-in approach, where for at least 5 years, only people with less than 10% market share would be able to open up their ownership to foreign owners.
Because otherwise the incumbents could just get the fuel to just absolutely crush. I mean, you know, the profit margins that our incumbents are generating are very attractive. And if you can maintain that kind of an edge, you know, you might be able to get foreign capital to do so. But if you have a set aside, then you can make sure that there's competition.
Well, that's right. But in terms of the ownership part, I mean, you can imagine that if you opened up the entire market to it, most of the foreign capital would probably flow to the incumbents.
Uh-huh. So we do need – it can't be a free-for-all. It has to be phased in a delicate way.
Exactly.
George, you mentioned OTT. Let's get back to just from the consumer end, because that's what really offended a lot of people about UBB, because it seemed very clear that what, you know, in the case of Rogers was happening was they were making it – they were afraid that the coming of Netflix meant that people were not going to maintain their cable subscriptions, and so they made it prohibitively expensive to download movies and television through Netflix, not just if you're a Rogers customer, but if you're with an indie ISP. And that was what I think got 500,000 people up in arms, whether or not they're tech-savvy customers. That just was not fair. So what is the future of OTT? If I don't want a cable subscription, I want to watch all of my movies and television through legitimate services over the internet, through an independent connection with tech-savvy or another company like that. How does this decision affect those OTT video viewers?
The decision is going to have a very profound impact on how that experience becomes socialized going forward. Certainly with respect to OTT, with respect to watching Netflix or watching any other. I mean, Hulu isn't even looking at this market. I mean, you want to talk about foreigners being leery to do business in Canada.
Yeah.
Just because there's no clarity and there's no prospect for a secure future within which to develop their business models. I think that OTT right now is completely in jeopardy because of the potentially prohibitive costs. And I think that, frankly, that's not unreasonably, that's probably a result that the vertically integrated entities were looking to achieve. It's not an accident.
Is OTT dead? I mean, we can figure this out. The math isn't difficult. If there's a cost savings in cutting your cable subscription and sticking only with internet, even if it's a more expensive internet service, even if my tech-savvy unlimited service goes up, it would have to go up, it would have to double for it to be more expensive than internet plus cable. If we're above a certain number, OTT is dead. And if we're below a certain number, if it's $10 cheaper, then there may be a future for it. I mean, do you care to?
I think you're exactly right. I think that if you look at the content consumption as a bundle, if you will, comprised of internet access as well as call it conventional television content, if you look at that as a bundle price, then I think that that with the introduction of a well-packaged and technologically accessible IPTV platform, which would allow consumers to pick and choose as they wish what kind of conventional content they want to watch alongside their OTT content, I think there's definitely a business there. My feeling is that certainly in the early days, probably for a few years, I think that that's going to be something that's going to benefit people who are forgive the expression, tech-savvy to some degree. I think it would probably reach broader, more broadly than that, but it'll be that somewhat, let's call them early adopter category. I think that for the more mainstream consumer, I think that they're going to feel a major, major damper. This is going to put a major damper on their OTT experience. And it's mystifying because obviously there has been an opportunity over the last 10 months to reflect very, very strongly on what direction we want this country to move in. And if that reflection has taken place, and if this is the conclusion that they've arrived at, then I think we have a lot of thinking and reconsidering to do.
Is there any hope in just like, you know, the numbers that the CRTC has in this decision? That is just the numbers that the incumbents can't go above. They can certainly go below. And, you know, I think their hope is that Bell and Rogers and the rest will actually get into a bit of a price war, and they'll want your business, and they will offer you rates that are lower than what's on that price list. I mean, is it possible that you're going to be able to introduce some kind of a market rationalization to this and find favor with the cheapest offer? Or do they just want you dead so much that they're just not going to budge on those prices?
Listen, let's keep the math simple. I won't give you the math, but at least I'll give you the concept. On the one hand, and on the one side of the ledger, you can put in the amount of money that they make from each wholesale sale that they make,
mm-hmm.
to whether it's a tech savvy or anybody else. On the other side of the ledger, take a look at the amount of money that they make from the person that does not switch from them to tech savvy. That's a huge differential. So whatever their wholesale win might be, on the other hand, as one customer goes from one side to the other, you know, there's a wholesale game. But on the other hand, on the retail side, it's a tremendous hit. So there isn't a tremendous amount of motivation, I believe, on the part of the vertically integrated entities to be very constructive and helpful and frankly competitive in driving wholesale sales to retail outlets. So I think that element of it is really, really questionable. I think it's a nice idea, but in any event, I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to fight to the death for wholesale business. I think that the much bigger agenda, obviously, is the retail relationships. So I'm not sure that it was a reasonable assumption on the part of the CRTC to think that they're going to fight so hard for our business to drive their prices down.
So every dollar they might make in winning your business, that Rogers might make by winning your business away from Bell or vice versa, they might be losing 10 if they only had that customer in their fold.
Overall, the bottom line is that they don't have a strategic interest in any kind of a robust competitive environment. So that kind of makes it easy to figure out how helpful they want to be in providing fair pricing to retail services.
George, this has been an incredibly depressing conversation. I want to thank you for it.
No, I don't think that it should be depressing. I think that we have a lot of reason to hope that the government is going to be sensitive and responsive to this issue. They certainly were in February, and I think that there's every likelihood that they may be in this case. I think that the Minister of Industry took a very prudent approach to this from the get-go. He made it very clear that they're going to study the decision very closely and decide how they're going to deal with it. And then there's also the recourse in the hands of the affected parties. So I don't think that I think what's really important is to have a very, very clear understanding of what the ramifications of this decision is. And certainly that clarity has come very much into focus over the last several days. And I think that you're going to be hearing an awful lot more about the pros and in particular the cons of the decision in the coming days.
George Berger, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Jesse. Thank you.
Search Engine is produced by me with help from Luke Simcoe and a community of listeners who know by now that the large print giveth and the small print taketh away. Email me at jesse@jessebrown.ca. Check out the blog. It is at tvo.org/search engine. The videos go up at youtube.com/tvosearchengine. And I'm on Twitter @jessebrown. This program is released with a Creative Commons license, which feels so right, even when I'm wrong. Next podcast will be up on Tuesday.